Good morning. What could be more primal than the sound of a didgeridoo for those of you who are listening to the opening music? Just gets under your rib cage. My name is Dick Beeman, and this is the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I want to welcome everybody here. The Unitarian Universalist Fellowship has no creed or dogma, but we do adhere to the seven principles that you can find in the back of your order of service. The theme of today's presentation is evolution, and because of that, I want to particularly point out to you that nowhere in the seven principles does it say that you must believe in evolution to be welcome here. So I would like to welcome everybody here, whether you think man was created by God in his image to have dominion over the earth, or whether you think human beings evolved from mudworms and pond scum and are about to go extinct and be replaced by intelligent cockroaches, or whether you believe that you're not sure what you have believed or whether your views are evolving, you are welcome here. Are there any visitors that would like to introduce themselves or be introduced? Yes, Anne.
Anybody didn't hear that? I'll repeat it. Madeline, my daughter, and her husband Peter, their daughter Clementine, and Lucy, my oldest daughter's daughter, and they're here from Kansas City.
So. Welcome. Any others?
My mother, Nancy Ralhan, visiting from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Welcome.
Shirley Hobrock. We have a couple new members that I'm not sure if everybody's met. They became members when we had our picnic at the 1st of June. Rita and Taylor, would you stand up? Rita and Taylor Bachman. And their two boys. They came from Colorado, so welcome them if you haven't already.
We encourage visitors to stay after the service for coffee and conversation and to sign the guest book at the back. The announcements can be found inside your order of service. Please read those carefully. Let's see, I forgot to appoint a chalice lighter. Connor, would you care to light the chalice today? Thank you. As we light the chalice today, I would like to say that today's chalice flame, symbolizes how scientific truth illuminates our lives and how each new scientific revelation can only deepen our evolving sense of wonder at the enchanting mystery of creation. And as we try to fathom the depths of the unknown, let's bear in mind that science can never demystify the universe, but can only increase our appreciation of its magnificence. Let's see. Please stand as you are able, and we will sing hymn 293, O Star of Truth.
However long the journey.
It's time for joys and concerns. Anybody have a joy or a concern? Kathleen.
Morning, I'm Kathleen Oldfather. I'm with the Caring Committee. And just wanted to say that I saw Jack Warren yesterday and his wife Alice Stockwell, and they were doing pretty well, and they're in the process of adding some extra help with some cooking and cleaning and daily things like that to their already couple of helpers that they have. And then I also saw Phil Kermser, who has moved to a different place at Meadowlark. He's now living in Honstead House, and he seemed to be in pretty good spirits. So that's my report.
I'd like to thank whoever did the work in the Inez Alsop room with the tile. It's absolutely wonderful, and I'm sure it's a lot of work, and I don't know who did it.
I guess Tom Manny and others, right? Other joys and concerns. Connor has a special comment that he would like to make up here.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
First, I want to thank the people that came up with the Spirit Mother program. I've really enjoyed spending time with my Spirit Mother every Sunday. You may have seen us outside under the tree talking. My Spirit Mother is Sarah, and she is moving away soon. So I want to tell her thank you. Sarah, you can come up here, please. Friends are always there. Honest, helpful, hopeful, lasting, laughing, sharing, always with you. Friends are always remembering the important things. Friends understand when no one else does. Friends are buddies who also stay close despite time and place. Friends give each other space and time. Friends know the meaning of smiles, laughter, and tears. Friends are special treasures who stand by you always. Through thick and thin.
Thank you.
Thank you for being my Spirit Mother. I will miss you.
Thank you, Connor. I'd like to deliver the first reading. This is from Stephen Jay Gould, evolutionary biologist. Look in the mirror. Do not be tempted to equate transient domination of the earth with either intrinsic superiority or prospects for extended survival. The human race is but a tiny, late arising twig on life's enormously arborescent bush, a small bud that would almost surely not appear a second time if we could replant the bush from seed and let it grow again. Children, come forward for the story.
First of all, it's going to be very, very hard to top Connor's presentation to Sarah. That was very nice. Thank you very much. Today, as Dick began to talk, we're going to be talking about questions of where we came from, where we people came from, where our dogs came from, where the garden you planted, where those plants came from, many, many societies, many, many groups of people have thought about this over the years, and they basically decide where they come from based upon what they know, what they have observed. So the story this morning I'm going to share with you is one of the stories that our kids really liked when they were young, and we liked it as well. It's the story of where daylight comes from, where the sun comes from. And it's from the Tlingit people who live in British Columbia, which wasn't British Columbia at the time, but it's up in Canada, over on the Pacific Ocean. Very wet, very moist, very cool area to live in. But they were thinking about where the sun comes from. And their story is based upon a long, long, long time ago, there was no sun. There was no daytime. Everything was dark. Darkness covered the mountains. Darkness covered the seas. And at this time, there were men and there were women, the Tlingit people who lived there. But they were also living in darkness. They were cold. There was no sun. And the raven, who is the hero of our story, was very sad for the Tlingit people. And he thought he would help. So he thought maybe that if there was a sun, maybe if there was light, maybe things would warm up for these cold people living in the darkness. So Raven flew across the valleys and across the mountains. He flew along rivers and along the ocean, looking for light, looking to see if he could find anything that would look like the sun. And way, way, way off in the distance, as he was flying over the mountains, he saw light. It was way, way far away at the edge of the water. So there's Raven looking for the light. As he got closer, he noticed the light came from a house next to the water. And the house was the home of the Sky Chief. It was shining brightly. So what Raven did was he perched himself on top of that big tree next to the house, and he watched. So there's the house of the Sky Chief. And as Raven watched, a beautiful young maiden came out of the Sky Chief's house, who happened to be the Sky Chief's daughter, and she went down to the riverside to drink. So there's Raven watching slyly from the top of the pine tree, and the beautiful daughter of the Sky Chief going down to get a drink of water from the stream that flows by. So there's Raven watching Sky Chief's daughter. And you can notice that there was light coming from inside the house. So thinking about it, watching the young girl drink water, Raven decided to change himself, because he was magical, change himself into a pine needle. And he floated down, 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 and landed on the water. And floated down near the daughter of the Sky Chief. And what did the Sky Chief's daughter do? Can you see? The pine needle went into her cup, and she drank the pine needle. So there's the Sky Chief's daughter drinking the pine needle. And after a time, according to this story, the girl gave birth to a child. The child was small, and he was dark. He had shiny black hair and very tiny black eyes. Who do you think the child was? Yep, it turned out it was the raven. Raven had been born as a small child. And the Sky Chief was delighted that his daughter had had a child. He played with the boy and he carved toys for him. He invited the elders to come and see this curious, wonderful child that does look curious. There's Raven as a child. He still has a beak, yeah. It wasn't a perfect transformation. So the elders gathered in the meeting house of the Sky Chief, and they watched Raven Child crawl around on the floor, and they thought he was just playing. He pretended to be playing, but he was actually looking for something. What do you think he was looking for? The light. Where's this light coming from? Is what he was thinking. And, right, he sees this box. So there's the boy child, or the raven child, crawling around the floor looking for the light. And in the corner of the lodge, he found a large box that was carved, beautifully painted, and light was coming from the box. And Ravenchild, pretending to be a little child, said, "Gag, gag, 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 gag." "And what do you want?" asked his mother. And then the raven child went, "Gag, gag, gag, gag." And then he started crying and carrying on. And the elders were concerned, "What does the child want?" And the grandfather was concerned, "What does the child want?" Finally, the grandfather noticed that he wants the box. So the young mother brought the box down, and the raven child continued to cry. So the mother took the lid off the box, and inside that box was another box, and inside that box was another box, and she continued taking off the lids until, there she is, taking off the lids of the box. Finally, in the bottom, there was a strong ball burning with light. And the raven child was very happy to see this, and the grandfather says, "Let him have the ball." So there's the ball inside the box. So Ravenchild pretends to play with the ball and rolls it around on the floor, and as he's playing, what happens to him? He starts turning back into the raven. So there's the raven child turning back into the raven, and what he does, what do you think he does? He takes the ball. He takes it in his beak, and he flies away with the ball. He leaves the Sky Chief's house, and he flies over the mountains and over the sea and over the villages, far away from the Sky Chief's house, and he throws the ball, which is the sun, as high as he can into the sky, and it stays there. And that is how the raven stole the sun, and he gave it to all the people. And that is why, to this very day, the Tlingit people honor the raven. They give him food to thank him for bringing the sun to their people. So now, go now in peace, go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you everywhere, everywhere you may go.
Thanks, Dave. Today is Helping Hands Sunday, and the beneficiary of today's donations is going to be Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Riley County. And I want to remind you that any donation that is not specifically earmarked for the Unitarian Fellowship will go to Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Riley County. And the spokesperson for that group today is Mark Scotchdoppel. Mark, are you here? And I apologize if I butchered your name, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you for selecting Big Brothers Big Sisters as to receive your Helping Hands funds. We greatly appreciate that. Your money goes a long way. You wouldn't believe just how little, as you know, budgets go down. The more that we can raise any way we can, the better off we can be, and the more youth we can help in this community. Just to give you a little inspiration to give, I wanted to tell you a little bit briefly about Big Brothers Big Sisters. Big Brothers Big Sisters was established in 1904 and is the nation's oldest and largest youth mentoring program. Big Brothers Big Sisters has been serving the Manhattan community for over 42 years. Our mission is simple: to help boys and girls, most of whom are considered at risk and living in single parent homes, achieve their full potential through long-term personal relationships with carefully screened and caring volunteers. We match children the age of 5 to 17 from various cultures and backgrounds with caring adults. In the community-based program, Bigs are mentors to littles by spending time doing activities together. We also have what we call a site-based program where they spend time going to school and spending time reading, studying, or eating lunch with the kids. And is a little out of date, but in 2008 we had 569 children were served by the Manhattan office. Just to back up the points of what a great organization and the work they do, research has found that after 18 months of spending time with their bigs, the little brothers and little sisters, compared to those children not in their program, were Number one, 46% less likely to begin using illegal drugs, 27% less likely to begin using alcohol, 52% less likely to skip school, 37% less likely to skip a class, and 33% less likely to hit someone. So as you can see, there's proven results. It costs, I believe, the financial support for our case managers engage in a thorough process, including multiple interviews, reference checks, background checks to ensure successful matches, and the resources required for this, just this process of matching a big with a little, is $600. So any money you give is greatly appreciated. Thank you again for your selecting us to receive those funds. And like I said, it goes to great use and great work to help out the youth of this community. So again, thank you very much.
By the time Charles Darwin published his theory of evolution in 1859, geologists had already shown that the Earth was very much older than previously thought. They didn't know the exact age with any precision. Estimates at that time ranged from millions of years to several billion years. But by the early 1800s, they knew that the Earth was almost unimaginably ancient. So even though the idea of the transmutation of species was being discussed by progressive thinkers long before Darwin, it is still true that as recently as the mid-1800s, just before Darwin's insights were published, many or even most biologists, geologists, other scientists and naturalists believed simultaneously in an ancient Earth, but also in the divine status of animal and plant species. So at the dawn of creation, millions or possibly billions of years previous, God had implemented his grand plan, had brought into being all the species that would ever exist. Each species created independently of all others. There was no kinship, or at least no common ancestry, between any two of those species, whether it was a blue whale and a housefly, a human and a chimpanzee, or even an eastern meadowlark and a western meadowlark. Not only no common ancestry, but no ancestry whatsoever, since every kind of animal and plant had been created from nothing, fully formed. Well, some of these species might later become extinct, and after all, in 1850, people already knew about dinosaurs, but no new species could arise. After this primary act of creation, only then did the secondary laws come into play. And those laws came into play for the remainder of eternity, and those laws governed the passage of species through time. So each species could show some variability, and this variability could be used by humankind for animal breeding and crop development through selection and propagation of desirable traits. And after all, people have been breeding dogs and improving wheat varieties for thousands of years. Everybody knew that. But this process of breeding for desired traits could occur only within each preordained species. And so trying to decide, for example, whether the Chinese elm and the Siberian elm were two varieties of the same tree or were two different kinds of trees, that was not merely a semantic exercise. That was nothing less than an attempt to discern the mind of the creator, to discern the intent of the creator. Well, that worldview, prevalent in 1850, was already showing a lot of cracks even before Darwin, but Charles Darwin's stunning and magnificent work, The Origin of Species, published in 1859, was the earthquake that made that cracked edifice start to crumble and topple. Now, that demolition's been a very slow process. A Harris poll conducted 3 years ago, 150 years after Darwin's publication, showed that fewer than half of all adult Americans believe in evolution. I'm now going to give an extended reading from the last chapter of Charles Darwin's Origin of Species, published in 1859. This is the chapter entitled Recapitulation and Conclusion. And by the way, when I read Darwin, I get a tingle in my spine. So if I shiver, that's why. You don't need drugs to get high. Just forget the drugs and read Darwin. Okay, so here's an excerpt from the last chapter. I have now recapitulated the chief facts and considerations which have thoroughly convinced me that species have changed and are still slowly changing by the preservation and accumulation of successive, slight, variable, favorable variations. Why, it may be asked, have all the most eminent living naturalists and geologists rejected this view of the mutability of species. The belief that species were immutable productions was almost unavoidable as long as the history of the world was thought to be of short duration. And now that we have acquired some idea of the great lapse of time, we are too apt to assume that the geological record is so perfect that it would have afforded us plain evidence of the mutation of species if they had indeed undergone mutation. But the chief cause of our natural unwillingness to admit that one species has given birth to another distinct species is that we are always slow in admitting any great change of which we do not see the intermediate steps. The mind cannot possibly grasp the full meaning of the span of 100 million years. It cannot add up and perceive the full effects of many slight variations accumulated during an almost infinite number of generations. Although I am fully convinced of the truth of the views given in this volume, I by no means expect to convince experienced naturalists whose minds are stocked with a multitude of facts, all viewed from a perspective directly opposite to mine. It is so easy to hide our ignorance under such expressions as the plan of creation or the unity of design, and to think that we are giving an explanation when we are really only restating an opinion. A few naturalists endowed with much flexibility of mind and who have already begun to doubt the immutability of species may be influenced by this volume. But I look with confidence to the future, to young and rising naturalists who will be able to view both sides of the question with impartiality. Whoever is led to believe that species are mutable will do good service by conscientiously expressing his conviction, for only thus can the load of prejudice by which this subject is overwhelmed be removed. Several eminent naturalists have of late published their belief that a multitude of reputed species are not real, but that other species are real, that is, have been independently created. This seems to me a strange conclusion to arrive at. These naturalists admit that a multitude of forms which until lately they themselves thought were special creations, and which are still thus viewed by the majority of their colleagues, and which consequently have every external characteristic feature of true species, they admit that these have been produced by variation, but they refuse to extend the same view to other and only very slightly different forms. Nevertheless, they do not pretend that they can define or even conjecture which are the created forms of life and which are those produced by secondary laws. They allow variation as the underlying cause in one case, but arbitrarily reject it in another, without assigning any distinction in the two cases. The day will come when this will be given as a curious illustration of the blindness of preconceived opinion. These authors seem no more startled at a miraculous act of creation than at an ordinary birth. But do they really believe that at innumerable periods in the Earth's history, certain elemental atoms have been commanded suddenly to flash into living tissue? Do they believe that at each supposed act of creation, one individual or many were produced? Were all the infinitely numerous kinds of animals and plants created as eggs or seeds, or rather as fully formed adults? And in the case of mammals, were they created bearing the false marks of nourishment from the mother's womb, the belly button? Although these naturalists very properly demand a full explanation of every difficulty from those of us who believe in the mutability of species, on their own side they ignore the entire subject of the first appearance of species in what they consider to be reverent silence. It may be asked how far I extend the doctrine of the modification of species. All the members of whole classes can be connected together by chains of affinities. Fossil remains sometimes bridge wide intervals between existing orders. Throughout entire classes, various structures are formed on the same pattern. At the embryonic stage, dissimilar species closely resemble each other. I believe that animals have descended from at most only 4 or 5 progenitors, and plants from an equal or lesser number. Analogy would lead me one step further, namely to the belief that all animals and plants have descended from one single prototype. But analogy may be a deceitful guide. Nevertheless, all living things have much in common in their chemical composition, their germinal vesicles, their cellular structure, their laws of growth and reproduction. Therefore, I should infer from analogy that probably all organic beings which have ever lived on this earth have descended from one single primordial form into which life was first breathed. When the views entertained in this volume on the origin of species are generally admitted, we can dimly foresee that there will be a considerable revolution in natural history. Naturalists who classify animal and plant forms will no longer be incessantly haunted by the shadowy doubt whether this or that form is a distinct preordained species. We shall have to treat species in the same manner as those naturalists treat species groups, who admit that such groups are merely artificial combinations made for convenience. We shall be freed from the vain search for the undiscovered and undiscoverable essence of the term species. The other branches of natural history will greatly rise in interest when we no longer look at an organic being as a savage looks at a ship, that is, as at something wholly beyond his comprehension. When we regard every production of nature as one which has had a history, when we contemplate every complex structure and instinct as a summing up of many contrivances, each useful to the possessor, nearly in the same way as when we look at any great mechanical invention as the summing up of the labor, the experience, the reason, and even the blunders of numerous workmen. When we thus view each organic being, how far more interesting will the study of natural history become? Our classifications will come to be genealogies, and there will truly and then will truly give what may be called the plan of creation. Living fossils will aid us in forming a picture of the ancient forms of life. Embryology will reveal to us the structure, in some degree obscured, of the prototypes of each great class. When we can feel assured that all the individuals of the same species and all the closely allied species within each group have, within a not very remote period, descended from one parent and have migrated from some one birthplace, and when we better know the many means of migration, then, by the light which geology now throws and will continue to throw on former changes of climate and of the level of the land, we shall surely be enabled to trace in an admirable manner the former migrations of the inhabitants of the entire world. Since species are produced by slowly acting and still existing causes and not by miraculous acts of creation, it follows that the amount of organic change in the fossils of consecutive formations probably serves as a fair measure of the lapse of actual time. During early periods of the Earth's history, when the forms of life were probably fewer and simpler, the rate of change was probably slower, and at the first dawn of life, when very few forms of the simplest structures existed, the rate of change may have been slow in an extreme degree. The whole history of the world, as at present known, although of a length quite incomprehensible by us, will hereafter be recognized as a mere fragment of time compared with the ages that have elapsed since the first creature, the progenitor of innumerable extinct and living descendants, was created. In the distant future, I see open fields for far more important researches. Psychology will be based on a new foundation, that of the necessary acquisition of each mental power and capacity by gradation. Light will be thrown on the origin of man and his history. Authors of the highest eminence seem to be fully satisfied with the view that each species has been independently created. To my mind, it accords better with what we know of the laws impressed on matter by the Creator, that the production and extinction of the past and present inhabitants of the world should have been due to secondary causes, like those determining the birth and death of the individual. When I view all beings not as special creations, but as the lineal descendants of some few beings which lived long before the first ancient fossil beds were deposited, they seem to me to become ennobled. As all the living forms of life are the lineal descendants of these as all the living forms of life are the lineal descendants of those which lived long before the Silurian epoch, we may feel certain that the ordinary succession by generation has never once been broken, and that no cataclysm has destroyed the whole world. Hence, we may look with some confidence to a secure future of equally indiscernible length. And as natural selection works solely by and for the good of each being, all corporeal and mental endowments will tend to progress towards perfection. It is interesting to contemplate an entangled riverbank or lakeshore, clothed with many plants of many kinds, with birds singing in the bushes, with various insects flitting about, with worms crawling through the damp earth, and to reflect that these elaborately constructed forms, so different from each other, dependent on each other in so complex a manner, have all been produced by laws acting around us. These laws, taken in the largest sense, being growth with reproduction, inheritance, variability from the indirect and direct action of the external conditions of life and from use or disuse, the ratio of population increase so high as to lead to a struggle for life, and as a consequence to natural selection, leading to a divergence of character and the extinction of less improved forms. Thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of higher animals, directly follows. There is grandeur in this view of life with its several powers, having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one, and that while this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. And now I give the podium over to our own Dave Lambert, who will give the program today.
In the beginning, the universe was out without form and was void. All was darkness, and all existed as potential. In an instant, nothingness exploded into existence. The absence of light became light. Darkness became day. Eons passed, and time, as Dick said, beyond our comprehension. Matter cooled and joined. Stars formed. Matter split and was thrown from the spiraling stars, yet clung to the parents. Eons continued to pass. Again, time beyond our comprehension. Our own star forms from the scattering dust. From this star, this sun that provides us a home, matter is flung from the center and cools in an ever-widening ellipse of encircling planets. Eons continue to pass. This third planet is violent in its creation, spewing fire and gases far different than any bucolic garden. As this planet spins, day follows night, as night follows day, immeasurably. As violence recedes and the environment changes, chemicals form together and are ripped apart. Eons continue to pass. 1 billion times, strings of chemicals join and are ripped apart. More time passes. Random changes continue in countless chemical strings. Some changes persist, most don't, and are destroyed. Once, about 3.5 billion years ago, a string of chemicals forms and persists. Some of those destined to survive replicate and prosper. Life begins. Through prospering, these early chemicals begin not just to be influenced by a changing environment, but indeed begin to change their surroundings. Eons continue to pass. The environment changes, and new accidents in the structure of life prosper. Old structures no longer fit for the changing environment die. After another 2 billion years, again, time without comprehension, or close to half of the time that the Earth has existed, these simple single-celled organisms that have held dominion over the Earth for 2 billion years were joined by multi-celled organisms. Life becomes more complex and perhaps more adaptable to change. Let's leap forward through 1 billion years of adaptation and planetary change. Life, once small and simple, becomes complex. Plants and animals fill the earth. Species appear, multiply, and eventually die. Beginning about 225 million years ago, large carnivorous reptiles appear and prosper. For 150 million years, dinosaurs ruled the earth. In a miraculous event 65 million years ago, the dominant assemblage of plants and animals suffered a dramatic change in their home, believed to have been caused by a gigantic meteorite striking the Earth. The Earth chilled. Plants died. Large reptiles, the apparent pinnacle of planetary life, were destroyed and lost their prominence. Changes wrought on the planet favored different animals, those with hair and those with feathers, those who could regulate their metabolism by staying warm when the planet turned cold. And this was good. With the passing of the reptilian lords of the planet, resources went untouched. New plants and animals spilled forth over countless millions of years. Changing plants and animals, better able to take advantage of the changing environment, prospered. Fast-moving ungulates were favored across vast areas of the planet's plains. Animals able to climb and move freely thrived in areas of dense vegetation. The waters of the earth, with their rich stores of nutrients, became populated with animals having fin and gill. Smaller animals, some with hair, some with feathers, and yes, even some with shells, prospered. Life on Earth changed, becoming home to both those plants and animals that were unaffected by the cataclysmic events underlying the extinction of reptiles and by new species arising in response to their new environment. And all of this was good. We, the species known as Homo sapiens, are today's lords of the planet, some even believing that we are given dominion over the fish of the sea and over birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. End quote. Our particular twig on the tree of life is the result of a trillion accidents over a period of time beyond our powers of imagination. Our own creation story, as now believed, begins over 6 million years ago in Africa, as one family rose upon their two legs and found that this was good. These small bands of our ancestors confronted climate and other environmental changes. Time once spent in the trees increasingly was spent on the ground. Our ancestors devised technology, forming stone tools about 2.5 million years ago, partly to prepare food, partly for warmth and for comfort. Fire was controlled, perhaps 800,000 years ago. With fire as a focus, our ancestors became more social, sharing cooked food and enjoying the company of their families and tribes around the fires. As we stretched our legs and wandered, and wanderlust grew, our ancestors faced increasing diversity in the habitats they entered. At the same time, the planet's climate became increasingly unpredictable. Fire helped, clothing helped, shelter helped. As environmental changes and challenges increased, adaptation favored those individuals having larger brains and the resulting capability to discover new ways to adapt to an ever more challenging environment. Our own Adam and our own Eve trace back to Omo 1 and Omo 2, both living about 195,000 years ago near the Omo River of Ethiopia. The Omos are the first Homo sapiens so far discovered, but the Omos were not alone. They had as neighbors Homo erectus, neighbors Homo neanderthalensis, the Neanderthals, and coming along a bit later, and far, far away from Africa, Homo florensis, nicknamed the Hobbit because of their short stature. They were only about 3.5 feet tall. They were also only discovered 9 years ago in 2003. Even our own people's journey has been rocky, as our own Homo sapien ancestors nearly became extinct 74,000 years ago, as continuing drought and high temperature strained our African ancestors' ability to survive. A trillion accidents, and sometimes violent, sometimes gradual environmental changes underlie our being here together this not quite as hot Sunday morning here in Manhattan, Kansas. We are truly blessed by how things have worked out for us. The process that has brought us together is a beautiful story and continues to become more complete and more complex and even more beautiful with each new discovery. But other pathways were always possible. Imagine the world of 80,000 years ago, before the movement of Homo sapiens from the African savanna to Europe and to Asia. Imagine the disappearance of the Neanderthals in Europe. Imagine the extinction of the branch of Homo erectus that did occupy Asia at that time. Evidence suggests that both of these events did occur. The Neanderthals did disappear. Homo erectus, our ancestors, disappeared from Asia. Further suppose that Homo erectus, those continuing to live in Africa, continued on and even prospered. Under this scenario, Homo sapiens may not have thrived and may, in fact, have disappeared. Here the tape changes from the one that did play. Had environmental changes caused the destruction of Africa's Homo sapiens before our ancestors had the chance to migrate to Europe or even open trendy restaurants in Los Angeles, humans would not be here. The accidents that did not occur, yet very well might have occurred, could have pruned the little twig on the mammalian branch called Homo sapiens, and our species would have joined the many, many failed accidents. Stephen Jay Gould is responsible for the scenario of our non-existence. Besides the obvious implication of a very limited market for his books, he asked the following question of Homo sapiens' disappearance. So what? This is the central question, regardless of one's acceptance of the creation of the universe and the evolution of our Earth's planets, or plants and animals, or believe instead in one of the many alternative stories societies have developed to understand where we came from, what happens when we die, and the question that surrounds our existence, so what? Elizabeth Strong, in a sermon she delivered in 2009 entitled A Theology of Evolution, celebrated the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth. Regardless of the story to which one adheres regarding our human origins, Ms. Strong's words focus on that question, so what? She goes on, although not alone among those with whom we share this planet, we as human beings are conscious of our existence. We accept the reality that we will die. We are aware that human birth creates new life and a new consciousness. We wonder where we came from. We question why we are here. We wonder what happens and if we go anywhere when we die. As our ancestors sat around their fires or watched the sun set over the Kenyan mountains, or as we drink our coffee and watch the traffic pass by, we have all regarded these questions with awe and mystery. In searching for answers and comfort, people found solace in the powers of the natural world. Many of those who came before us, and many of those with whom we share this planet, came to believe that supernatural beings controlled the sky, the earth, and their lives. In the circles around the hearth fires of their caves, our ancestors began to create stories of how life began, how the earth and the sky began, where the sun came from, and why death takes loved ones away. Stories of creation are part of every culture in every time. People sprang from coyote. People arose from unions of the gods. God formed Adam fully formed, if not fully clothed, from the dust of the ground. And in an early application of stem cell research, God yanked a rib while Adam was asleep and formed Eve. The creation stories helped people understand how they came to be, what happened to them in their daily lives, and provided comfort as they contemplated their own deaths. Being created by, and thus important to those who created them, people have worked out relationships with these supernatural powers of nature. Over the millennium, humans have explored and increased their understanding of the world. They accumulated what they learned in the fields of knowledge, seeking answers to things that they did not understand. Over the centuries, faith mixed with increasing knowledge, often giving rise to conflict, dissension, and even excommunication. As religions formed and created their own stories of understanding, while alternative stories arose as a result of scientific inquiry, conflict between different views of nature escalated. At the extreme, war between scientific understanding and religion created rigid walls of animosity. Science and faith became realms unto themselves. This uneasy truce that emerged was shattered in 1859 when Charles Darwin published his book On the Origin of Species. Darwin was born over 200 years ago, as we said. He was part of the deist Unitarian movement of the time, so of course we lay claim to him as one of our ancestors, religious ancestors. Although we celebrate his birth, we also celebrate the reason for his fame, the publication of his blockbuster book in 1859. So what are these heretical tenets upon which Darwin's theory rests? The four major propositions underlying Darwin's theory, linking natural selection to evolution, are more individuals are produced than can survive, number one. Competition leads to a struggle for existence, number two. Within a population, individuals are different, number three. And number four, offspring tend to inherit their parents' characteristics. That's all. Anyone taking ecology in the last 50 years probably has heard the story of the English peppered moth. I know I did when I took ecology in the last 50 years. Before the Industrial Revolution, the natural coloration of this moth was white with tiny black wing speckles, allowing it to disappear against the lichens of England's forests. With the Industrial Revolution and the subsequent besmirching of city environments with smoke, soot, and grime, a white moth stood out like a tasty tidbit at nature's salad bar. Amongst the population of moths were a few black individuals. Although dark stood out against the lighter background of the pre-industrial revolution, dark was a good color to be when pollution killed the area's lichens and soot settled over the trees. The darker moths gained an advantage. They were eaten less often, and they tended to have dark babies. Each of Darwin's propositions applies in this case. The black moths prevailed in the urban environments of England during the Industrial Revolution. As environmental regulations were applied and Britain's pollution lessened, the English peppered moth again responded with more and more of the white variety. They prospered, the white variety prospered and regained their prominence. One can perhaps interject the guiding hand of a supreme being behind this transformation of the English peppered moth. A guiding hand may have been at work, but there really is no need anywhere in the story for that hand being attached to a supreme being. In the years following the publication of On the Origin of Species, Unitarians and Universalists, separate at the time, engaged in dialogue over the theories resulting from Darwin's observations and conjectures. 100 years ago, these debates enabled our faith forebears to embrace reason and scientific inquiry that were embodied in evolution, without, at the time, denying the wonder and power of their faith in God. In 1900, 112 years ago, the Reverend Dr. Martin Shutter, minister of the Universalist Church of the Redeemer in Minneapolis, Minnesota, presented 12 lectures entitled Applied Evolution, in which he placed Darwin's theories within the context of universalist theology. Thousands attended the lectures. The lectures provided universalists of the time with an understanding of these new theories and how they could strengthen their faith and their beliefs. As now, traditional religious beliefs were in conflict with scientific discoveries. Shutter began his lectures with a case for how science aided religion by stating that the long battle between science and religion was, to a certain extent, a mistake. Not only is there no real conflict, Shutter stated, when we come to understand the subject, religion or religious thought, so far from suffering disaster at the hands of science, has been the actual gainer. It has lost nothing but some unscientific notions that were long but erroneously supposed to belong to religion. It is better without them. It stands upon solider footing. It can make stronger appeal to the human intellect. Shutter identified three improvements in religion resulting from these scientific discoveries. Number one, science taught theology to look at facts as they are and not as it wishes or hopes or imagines or guesses them to be. Two, science taught theology something about right methods of reasoning. We cannot receive by direct revelation that which depends upon study and research. His third point was that science delivers theology from the wretched habit of defending doctrines because of their supposed usefulness. Science has greatly enlarged our conception of the universe. The church's perception of the cosmos in the Middle Ages pales in comparison to Larry Weaver's talk a year ago. I'm glad Larry was able to be with us this morning. Larry Weaver's talk a year ago of the origins and the beauties of our own universe. Science has to do simply with cataloging facts and understanding the processes of nature. Purpose and destiny
are questions for philosophy and religion. Schutter believed that humans, instead of being created by a single fiat of omnipotence several thousand years ago, is seen in the light of evolution to have first risen 200,000 years ago, in line with the fossil record, and then wandered through the forests and caves and jungles of the earth instead of dwelling in a beautiful garden. That humans made and improved upon implements of wood and stone, and they harvested plants and animals to provide for their tribes. Thus, evolutionary theory, according to Schutter, gave religion a new way to understand the creation of humankind. In this next segment that I'll quote from Schutter, recall that he's speaking from the platform of 1900. Schutter quotes or states, "And we hold that it is better and nobler, better to have risen from cave and jungle than to have fallen from Eden. Better to have developed from the animal than to have degenerated from the angel. Better to have begun at the bottom and toiled to the top than to have begun at the summit and rolled down to the base. Better to have the golden age before us than behind us. Better to be on the way to perfection with hope and with courage than to be expelled, discrowned, and dishonored away from perfection." Elizabeth Strong concludes her sermon from several years ago with the words of Harvard biologist Edward Wilson. Wilson states, "For us, the history of life and of the universe as told by science becomes more than a sequence of strange and arresting events. It becomes our personal and our shared story, our creation story, our sacred story." He goes on, "The evolutionary epic is probably the best myth we will ever have." He does not mean that myth does not mean, well, he states, "Myth does not mean falsehood, but is the grand narrative that gives us a placement in time, a meaningful placement that celebrates extraordinary moments of a shared heritage. For those of us who have not only learned but embraced the evolutionary scientific story of our roots, know ourselves to be reworked stardust, biological beings with a multi-billion year pedigree. We know these facts deeply, and for us, they're as empowering as any tale that has ever come alive in the flames of a fire at the mouth of a cave or in the vaulting echoes of a cathedral." Stephen Jay Gould addresses the question, "So what?" He says, "Humanity arose just yesterday as one small twig on one branch of a flourishing tree. Life does not, in any sense, exist for us or because of us." Rather than accepting the devastation such a theory might cause in one supposing a supernatural explanation for human existence, we should embrace this reality and seek with joy the meaning of human life in domains that do not rely upon our perceived place in the universe. I guess we do have time for a bit of discussion. Dick, you want to join me?
Thanks for sharing that beautiful myth, Dave. Discussion?
One minute.
Sylvia?
This is for Dick, right?
Well, there are two things I wanted to talk about. You can tell me to shut up at any point. There was a Unitarian book that used to be part of the Sunday school curriculum. It was called The Bushmen of the Kalahari. And they, I mean, we talk about how people maybe took literally their creation stories, but that's possibly not really true. Maybe only people now do. But the Bushmen of the Kalahari, they found out when they would ask them to tell the creation story, they told a different version of the story every time. They knew that they didn't have a definitive answer, and it was partly for amusement purposes, or, you know, they didn't think of it as the answer. That's one thing I wanted to say. And the second thing is that there are two other really interesting aspects of that impinge on evolutionary theory, and one is that critics of Darwinism's theory of gradual change by accumulation of mutations said that it couldn't have happened fast enough to account for all the variability of life forms. And so then there's a more recent modification called punctuated, what is it called?
Equilibrium.
That that evolution proceeded by fits and starts, vast changes and then slower, periods of slower change. And there's a lot of accumulating evidence that there is vast insertion of genetic variability by microbes and symbiotic relationships. And to me, that's a really exciting development. And that's in progress now and probably always has been. You can just tell on the cellular level, if you just look at a cell, they're like our ribosomes contain their own genetic material. And in plant cells, the chloroplast has its own genetic material also. Those are all indications that we are accumulations of other life forms that came to be sort of amalgamated into one thing. And the second thing is epigenetics, which is this new area of research that shows that environmental effects can have changes on genetic expression that last for several generations. For instance, one of the cases that was recently studied was that people who were exposed to starvation during World War II had physiological effects for several generations after that.
We're going to ask Sylvia to tell next year's creation myth story. Other comments? Tom, did you have something to say? Okay. Chris,
is there anything we could do to jumpstart evolution in Kansas?
I'm not going to touch that one. I think that the evidence does support the fallacy of believing that we are at the pinnacle of development.
I think it's very good that we're talking about this today, as this undoubtedly will be a hot issue in the November elections for the state school board, as science standards are once again coming up for review. It seems like this is the unending story of Kansas and our science standards. Even though our science standards currently are some of the best in the nation, and other states are modeling their science standards on ours, but there'll be this drive to once again take out evolution and put creationism in as a alternative theory. So I guess my question to you two scientists is, can you give us a two-sentence, simple language way to refute that creationism is a valid alternative theory to evolution?
I could give it a stab. It's a question of, the issue really is, what is a scientific question and what isn't a scientific question? A scientific question is one, or a scientific theory is one, that can be disproven. If you make a statement that is incapable of being disproven, then there's nothing more to be said about it. There's no proof or disproof is possible. So a useful scientific theory has to be one that is disprovable. And if you just say, you know, if you have a theory of creation, again, that is not disprovable, then it's not science and shouldn't be taught in a science class. That's part of the answer.
His comment just reminded me about 2 years ago, Connor was, even though I was homeschooling him, he'd go to daycare for an hour while I was attending a class, and one day I go to pick him up, and the lady answers the door, and she's slightly red-faced and very irritated looking, and I'm going, oh God, what did he do? And she's like, well, somehow or another they got on the discussion, and they were very Christian and believed very strongly in creationism, and he looked at her and he says, yeah, but there's no proof. So we had to have the discussion of, well, you have to let them have their beliefs, and it's okay to have your beliefs, and just don't ruffle feathers.
Actually, Chris, I'm an economist, so I guess that sort of satisfies as a scientist, but of a different ilk. interesting. I wonder if, in preparing for this talk, I looked at various creation myths, and one of the Osage Indians who lived a bit east of here was that man evolved, that's a bad choice of words, the snail was our predecessor. We came from snails. And I wonder if Connor had used that story, if it would have been more acceptable in daycare, if he had said, my religion believes that the snail climbed out on the log and grew arms and legs and became humans. I wonder if that would have been more acceptable to a Christian than the evolutionary theory that we profess.
This is for Dick. I've often heard the remark made exactly as you made it, that to be a scientific theory, it needs to be disprovable. What would you need, what kind of evidence would be needed to disprove evolution?
Well, I think about that. I'm going to let Steve give his answer.
Well, a single fossil being in the wrong place, on the wrong level, in the wrong order. No, they're not. They're all where they're expected to be.
Yeah. Well,
if you found a dinosaur and a human in the same place, you've got your disproof.
This doesn't relate to Larry's question, but what strikes me in all of this is I have no comprehension of the time that has elapsed. The universe was, what, 14.5 billion years ago was the Big Bang. Our Earth was 4.5 billion. I don't know what that means. And the amount of time that it would take for somebody like Steve to appear on this planet, the 4.5 billion years, just beyond my comprehension of the amount of time involved.
I have a partial answer to Larry's question, but first let's let Chris give his comment.
So I want to reply to Larry's comment. My feeling in physics is reproducibility is one of the cornerstones of building the theories. And so I feel like asking for a single piece of evidence is going to be hard. And so if what Stephen said, you found two fossils in the wrong place, that's not enough. But if you see two fossils in the wrong place and it's happening all the time, and it's just building up, and you, the pattern is broken, and we can consistently see that. So I think the evidence for disproof is kind of, it's a tall order. You can't do it once.
Yeah, you could imagine geological discoveries or discoveries of fossils that would make the theory of evolution much less likely than it is. But everything that's been observed is very consistent with the theory, even if it's not absolutely provable without a time machine. If we had a time machine, maybe we could prove it.
Blind fanatical ignorance.
Maybe one more comment? One more?
Well, I understand there's a creation museum in Kentucky where dinosaurs and humans are together, verifying the fact that they once lived together. So I'm sure. A visit to Kentucky or Arkansas, possibly, where you find the living fossils today. So if I've insulted anyone from Arkansas, I'm glad.
Well, it's almost quitting time. There's a lot of unknowns. We're never going to understand everything, but let's enjoy the dance of life, and let's sing a song about dance.
Yeah, and please join us in the narthex afterwards for coffee and refreshments.
Please stand as you are able.
Hymn number 3111 or 311.
Mm-hmm. Let it be a day.